We kick off the hour by welcoming back to the program our friend, author Colin Fleming. Colin, good afternoon.
How's it going, Kimball?
Very well, thanks. I am excited for this book, one of many that you're working on, but this I know is going to be terrific. It's going to be called Watching Back, Writing on Movies That Light Us Up. What's the premise of the book going to be?
I like films that have an impact on showing us who we are. Going to the darkened movie theater and the lights are out and up comes that image on the screen and we're looking into another world. But what happens if we think of that as being reversed? That's how I think the best pictures always work, that they're actually shining their light at us. And there we are, the screen, so to speak, being lit up. And we sort of look in our chest at our heart and everything. And we think, oh, that's how that's working. And that's why it's going that way. And we look inside of our heads and other things like that. And so I think the best movies, like the best art, they show us ourselves as we are and in ways that we don't see when we're just on our own. And that's really the point. I think that's the point. And if it's entertaining at the same time, then that's really what you're going for. So I care about films of that nature. I care about books and records and walks in the forest and the rare people out there of that nature. But yeah, so that's what the sort of premise of the book is.
Well, and a piece from the book that we're going to discuss today is about a filmmaker who certainly had a number of accolades during his career. People probably know him best for films like An Affair to Remember, The Awful Truth, one of my favorite holiday films, Going My Way. But Leo McCarey had a very interesting career, but isn't, as you point out, isn't regarded in the same light as contemporaries like a Frank Capra. Why is that?
He's not like a Frank Capra, but I would say the comparison to draw in terms of people whom he's not compared with are the auteurs. Capra is a studio system guy, and he's in that middle period of the studio system era, like McCarey. But I'm thinking almost Howard Hawks, John Ford. They got credit as being auteurs, and Ford had such a long career, and well, they both really had long careers, but they were making significant movies in the 1950s, and Ford would go on and have some in the 1960s that were also notable works of art, but no one thought of Leo McCarey as an auteur. An auteur to me in film is someone who comes along and they have a vision, or better yet, a series of progressive and contrasting visions, and they bring those visions to bear on their work. So in order for me to think of you as a top-tier auteur, you're versatile. Howard Hawks was very versatile, for instance, but you always knew it was a Howard Hawks picture, no matter the different genre, the different style, and the different kind of actors he used. But no one really thought in terms of auteurs in the 1930s, in the 1920s too, which is when McCarey started coming up, and then he really established himself in the 1930s. So he's before that sort of critical notion of this person who does these specific artistic directing-based things. And I think not only is he arguably the first of a line of auteurs, I don't know that we have a better one in the history of cinema in this country.
Now, McCarey started out working in comedies with Hal Roach, worked with Laurel and Hardy, was writing jokes for the Our Gang series. You write McCarey began as a humor man, which is important to note for everything that McCarey would go on to become. Humor does not exist without tragedy and vice versa.
Right. And so for people who might be of a certain age, and I'm not saying you have to stretch back to the 1920s to know Our Gang, but they lived on in television repeats for quite a while. I remember they would even still circulate when I was a kid in the 1980s, so they had some staying power. But the humor was quite broad. It was the humor of the chubby guy bending over and his pants splitting. There was a lot of that. So it was interesting that McCary started in that broad vein, because he was a particularly incisive man, filmmaker, artist. He was responsible for pairing Laurel and Hardy together, kind of like a big, what's that candy with the chocolate and the peanut butter? I feel like this is a pretty big one for comedy. And so he moved to directing with them, and he directed a handful of their pictures. And he grumbled later that the advent of sound killed Laurel and Hardy, which I think is a humorous take on that particular duo, because that's one of the rare times I would say that McCary wasn't correct in his critical judgment, which he excelled at, as we'll see. But I don't think many people. So the sound era starts essentially with 1930. And when now we remember Laurel and Hardy films, or we treasure them or rewatch them, they're usually the films from the 1930s when there's not a ton of talking, but the talking is pretty important and they're both quite good at it. So he was doing those comedies. He was moving through the ranks. He graduated from USC Law, and he was a fighter. He was like working at a sawmill. He was doing things that lawyers don't do. And at the time, if you were a good-looking guy who did rugged things, you kind of tried to make it in the new old west of Hollywood. Todd Browning took him aside and he said, "Look, I know you are a really handsome man, but don't do the acting thing. You can connect with more people on the creative side of matters." And so Leo McCary took that advice to heart.
We're talking with Colin Fleming about his upcoming book, Watching Back, Writing on Movies That Light Us Up. And the piece centers on the pivotal year of 1937, when Leo McCary made two films. One of them received a great deal of acclaim, and that's the movie that so many people know, The Awful Truth. Let's talk about that one first. It was certainly one that set the template for those screwball comedies, for the Cary Grant character in many ways.
If you don't know The Awful Truth, it actually turns out in a way you do. If you've never seen it, and this is the first you've ever heard about it, because what The Awful Truth established was the Cary Grant persona. And Cary Grant, so if you've seen North by Northwest, in a way, you've seen The Awful Truth. You know what I mean? Because Cary Grant was always Cary Grant in the movies. There's not like, well, this is when he played a melancholic alcoholic. Do you know what I mean? That picture doesn't exist for Cary Grant. He's always suave and debonair. He's like you, but in the movie. So you know how that works. A lot of pressure to live up to that persona every time out. But they had similar names. And sometimes that's all it is in life, Leo McCary, Cary Grant. So they became sort of buddies. And on the set, McCary could be annoying in some ways, because he had a piano brought in, he'd play the piano, and he would wait for ideas to come to him while everyone else had to horse around and mill about, that kind of thing. So he decided, with Cary Grant's input as well, that let's just have you be loose. Let's go for it. Let's improvise some stuff. And that character came out. And that character was a hit with audiences during that time period, just like screwball comedies. And really, McCary helped initiate the screwball comedy craze, was big with Depression-era audiences. It was a form of harmless anarchy for people who felt very boxed in and lacking control and a voice and a say in their lives. So there's a reason why a lot of times these things happen when they do, or need to happen when they do. And Leo McCary was excellent at sensing what that was and responding to the historical moment. So people really liked this particular film, and it did well in that it netted McCary a Best Directing Oscar. Now, Oscars are a bugaboo with me. I don't know why, if you care about the movies, you would care about Oscars. Anyone can go back and look at what's won over the years, and they're almost always forgettable films. They're a kind of milquetoast, vanilla, safe, conformist drama that's not laden with life. That's usually what wins. And so Orson Welles and John Ford and Howard Hawks and Alfred Hitchcock, they weren't like kings of the Oscar ceremony. But Leo McCarey did win the Oscar, directing Oscar, for this particular film.
And a turning point in your story is when McCarey got up to accept that Oscar and said to the audience, who apparently were stunned by his comment, "You gave it to me for the wrong picture." And that's what this beautifully written piece is about. A movie that a whole lot of people don't know or haven't seen, but might not just be the best thing McCarey did, but one of the best films of all time, Make Way for Tomorrow.
Oh, yes. It's a top 10 type of film for all time. And it's the first of two pictures that McCarey had made that year in 1937. The Awful Truth was the second one. It was with a different studio than he had worked with before, because Make Way for Tomorrow had put the kibosh on his run at that earlier studio. It has been described as the most depressing movie ever made. Graham Greene, who was a film critic in addition to being a novelist, but only a film critic for really the second half of the 1930s, absolutely hated this movie. And it brought out a darker side of him where he descended into what I think of as a kind of ageism. But the people who loved this film were people who really knew how to make, not just knew how to make film, but knew how to connect with people. Frank Capra loved it. It prompted no less than Jean Renoir to say that Leo McCarey understood people. And Orson Welles, who, when Orson Welles really spoke highly of films, they were films that you needed to see. He didn't err in his judgments or his esteem. When Orson Welles says that The General is one of the whatever, two best American movies ever made, you're probably going to want to pay attention to a statement like that. And he esteemed Make Way for Tomorrow greatly and remarked that it could make a stone cross. And it sounds like, oh, geez, I don't want to, life's hard enough, man. I don't want to be brought down by a movie. I'm going with my kids to see Mario Brothers. That's all I can take. Don't leave this life. Don't die before you see Make Way for Tomorrow, whatever age you are. It's like we're here to go around and have certain experiences that can't be passed up. This is one of them. And it's an uplifting film when you give it a chance and when you come to it on its terms and you let it do what it's going to do with you. It's going to do it anyway, really. All you have to do is be in its presence.
And in many ways, it's a film of its time, but the message and the story, the people involved and their reactions are timeless. It's an older couple who have come on hard times, as so many did during the Great Depression, and it falls upon their children to have to take care of them. And is it safe to say that none of them are really up to the task?
Yes, I think that you are good to go with that statement. I don't think anyone who saw this film, or frankly, and I hope I don't sound too cynical, has had experiences with family, at least some experiences, would dispute that claim. It's, like you said, it is a product of its time in terms of the plot, the engine of the plot. People obviously didn't have money, and when you don't have money, they don't have space, and homes were being lost, and we have this, like you said, older couple, but not like 90, still functioning and everything, and the actual actors, Victor Moore and Balua Bandai, were only around the age of 60, each of them, so they were made to look older than they were. And don't forget, too, at the time, extending to the 1970s when Bob Montgomery was the catcher of the Red Sox, people looked older than they do now. So they lose their home to foreclosure, and they have these kids, four of whom are local and one who lives in California. And that's the kind of Chekhov's gun notion of plotting. That's going to be significant. It's not just there, some random insertion. And so the couple have to find a place to live. And the families, the kids, the ingrate for offspring, they prevaricate. And they end up splitting up the couple. so that one is going with this family and another is going with this family. But they're still in the same rough area. They can still see each other, and it's supposed to be temporary. One of the kids' daughter, who has the best, really, or the most space, the solution for them, she gives this line about, oh, I have to clear with my husband, and that's going to take 3 months. When someone says something like that to you, you know they're lying to you. So you have a daughter lying to the kids, who really just care about their own immediate families. And they're not looking at it as an opportunity, too, where you get to have these people in your life. That's an opportunity. I mean, I didn't have that myself, or grandma or whomever lived with us. But that's also, I bet, a lot of people who do look back on that experience, and they're grateful that they had that time and they were able to benefit from that counsel and that wisdom. And sometimes, like I wrote in the piece, mom and dad, they're grinding through life. They're up close to everything. And to be able to step out of the room and have a word with someone wise who loves you isn't a bad thing. And we have this, for instance, this heartbreaking moment. It's very upsetting with this teenage granddaughter. And the line that Lucy, the Bark's wife, says throughout is that Bark's going to find work again and they'll be able to live back on their own. But you know it's not going to happen. And she knows that, too. And the granddaughter says it's time to face facts, just the way children talk. They don't care how it comes. And Lucy says it's easier to face facts when you're a teenage girl. And can I just pretend for a while?
And you're right. I think this is a wonderful, the way you sum this up. As things begin to go wrong, not only in this story, but boy, we see it all the time today in the world of social media. People look for other things to blame, and they don't see the connections and how things happened. You're right. When we experience extreme pain or loss, or believe that we have, we're apt to bemoan a strain of ignorance. We express shock and profess a lack of understanding. One reason we do so is to underscore how unfair it is that we've been made to suffer in this fashion. Proverbial rhyme and reason absconded in the night, and with the silverware to boot. But we can know. There were factors, however, beyond the pale and atypical, a chain of events, and I think this is crucial, often a chain of choices.
Yes, and it's like we deny the existence of cause and effect.
Mm.
And McCary's films function with cause and effect. He called it, he referenced it as the ineluctability of incidents, meaning this happens, and as a result of that happening, this other thing happens, and then this thing happens subsequently. So we just generally choose not to look at the progression, because we usually have a role in the progression too, something that we could have done that we didn't do, something that we did do that we ought not to have done. Not all the time, but it's often that way. The great monster, for all of the Draculas and the werewolves and the creatures from the Black Lagoons and everything, there's no monster to rival the ultimate monster. And the ultimate monster is the mirror.
Mm.
People are in terror of the mirror. It will make them come apart. It will make them respond with force and anger. It will make them do everything they can to smash the glass and stick you with a shard of it if you happen to tote the mirror into their place in the first place. So that's what's happening with these offspring. They know at the same time, and there's like I said, McCary was a musician, and there's this moment towards the end where, well, the final reels of this picture are just some of the most beautiful things you'll ever see, but we get this cutaway from the day that Lucy and Bark are having together, where we see the kids, their kids, and one of them makes reference to how terrible they've been. But the way that it concludes over those final reels is they're supposed to be like a Last Supper. What is ending up happening is Bark had a cold, so of course the child seized upon that as an opportunity to shuttle him off to California. And once he goes to California, that's it. It's like a death, really. They're not going to probably ever see each other again, this married couple. And so they're going to be having this kind of last supper with their kids. And before that, though, they go out into the city they're going to have a day together. And this is where the depressing notion is mitigated against. They are met constantly with the kindness of strangers who are touched by what they have together, who recognize that and who value that and who are able to pick up on how rare that is. And maybe it also makes them grateful if they have it too, or it makes them want to find it all the more. And they end up blowing off this family gathering, this event. And it's not like you would think. This isn't like the Sex Pistols giving you the middle finger or anything. But it's such a defiant, important moment in principle. And you're not able to say that often about any kind of a movie. There's a wry humor, too, at the edges of this movie, because McCary said it was impossible for him to not have some of the comedy if he was doing tragedy and vice versa. He understood that. But when they stay out on their own to continue this last outing together, it makes you happy. It makes you, it's like in the British version of The Office, the Christmas special, when David Brent, this like pathetic, sad sack, irritating character, has this moment of redemption and tells Chris Finch, the always irksome Chris Finch, to go bleep himself. It's sort of like that.
I think of the title of this film, and you write that it's based on a novel called The Years Are So Long, but just that phrase, make way for tomorrow, I think of it in the context of the times. You know, 1937, FDR in the process of creating the Social Security system, which was the ultimate make way for tomorrow, a system designed to get older people off the work rolls and out of the way to make room for those young, vibrant people. And how all these years, 70, 80 years later, we have a whole industry built around taking care of the old people and getting them out of the way so the children can live their lives while mom and dad, granddad and grandpa are shipped off to these retirement factories, and we don't have to deal with them because, yeah, you got to make way for tomorrow.
It was even reflected in the poster art for the movie. If you look at, if you even just go on Wikipedia and you look at the original one sheet, it's a man, like a young man, passionately kissing a young woman. It's not Bark and Lucy. They're down in the corner kind of looking on. So you have the sense that every now and again they're going to pop into the movie and do a Yoda kind of line sort of thing, put in a little crusty wisdom, and off they go again. Although they are billed. I mean, they'd have to be billed. They carry, acting-wise, the picture at the top of the listed names for that. But it was as if the movie was trying to hide what it was before it came out. And we don't have a lot of films, too, that are quote-unquote old-person films. But you know what? It's like I wrote in the piece. They're the youngest people in the movie. Mm. I mean, what's age really going to mean?
And you say because they haven't calcified. What do you mean by that?
They're not these human calluses. Mm. They're living, breathing, soft, fleshy feeling. If you stick them, they're going to wince or cry, whereas stick somebody else and it's just another inconvenience for the tough hide. That, and it's not the tough hide of experience, it's the tough hide of looking away and of cowardice. They're brave people. They view the world with that childlike wonder that we've talked about. They view each other. They view their love. When I say these things, I don't know how you can make a claim that such a work could actually, in the end, sum total, be depressing. These are things that are of great beauty and of great consequence and of great warmth and rarity. We don't just have them all the time. I mean, what does a year mean, save another leaf off a calendar? We've talked about this before. I know plenty of people who are done at 30, done. Mm. It's all over. They're not. I haven't known a ton of people who are 80 for whom it's necessarily not all over, but it's not like I've known more, quote-unquote, younger people who are closer to fitting that bill. It's rare. The youthful spirit of teeming, abounding life is rare. But these two people at the center of this movie, they have it. They're more alive than anyone in it. So it's not like an old person movie, which is how Graham Greene wrote it off. He's quite flippant about it. It's like depressing and brings everyone down, and it's just these old people. You wonder if like he was projecting something into it. And it Leo McCarey made this because it meant a lot to him. His father had died, and he went looking for a treatment, and he happened to find this novel by an advice columnist that became this play, and then someone else wrote the screenplay off of the play. So it looks like it might be diluted, but it was nothing at all. And so no one liked this when it came out. They didn't really, I feel like, give it a chance. A lot of things come down to how much of a chance they're going to be given and the position that they are put in to succeed. The Beatles records came out on a Chicago label called VJ, and those early singles, they did nothing. Same exact material a few months later. It has nothing. It's just, it got a chance. I don't feel like this had a chance, and that definitely, I don't know that it hurt Leo McCarey, because I think he knew that this transcended this kind of stuff, but he did take to the stage at those Oscars, and everyone's clapping, and they're thinking, we love this Cary Grant. You established this persona. Good for you. And he just says, like you had relayed, you gave it to me for the wrong picture. Everyone just stares at this guy, because who does that? And it's like, okay, see ya. I mean, talk about, we speak of a mic drop. He's like, that's like going to the top of the Sears Tower and dropping this thing. I mean, that's awesome. I love that. I love stuff like that. It makes me want to compete and create something great.
And in terms of the reaction, how much of that do you think was the time that it was released? That as is often the case in tough times, people don't always want to be confronted with tough truths. And that's why I was reading a piece just the other day about local theaters here in Maine and how they found post-COVID people who go to the theater just want light entertainment. They don't want anything that's too heavy and might make them think. And I wonder if that was the case in the Depression and those years, that people didn't want anything that was also going to, as you mentioned, turn that mirror on them and force them to take a look at their life and some of their choices.
And the irony is, when you just want the light, or you say you do and you stick to it, you end up becoming more depressed, because a part of your brain that rules a big chunk of you, the subconscious, it knows that you're not trying and you've tapped out, and you're also getting lesser fare, and you're not, it's the same as exercise. You go out and you exercise a little bit, whatever it is for you, a lot, a little, something. You feel better. It's an endorphin thing. There are endorphins of the heart and the soul. And when you partake of things of consequence that reach out and touch your heart and soul, it uplifts you. You don't feel actually worse unless you're committed to feeling worse. But that's a you thing. That's not a make way for tomorrow thing. That's not, another example would be Orson Welles' Magnificent Ambersons. So that's what, a few years after, and it's before U.S. Was really going to come out of everything after World War II. And if you look at the preview cards from the audiences who were shown this film before it was officially released, and it could be recut and edited and all that kind of stuff. People hated it. There are these humorous, albeit depressing, responses from people saying, "We don't want real life. Make us laugh." And really, it's like written like that, because they went across the street and got people from like the Jack in the Box and brought them in to do this. And you think, huh? Well, if that's the Magnificent Ambersons, you can see how it was a tough go for Make Way for Tomorrow. But I think really, in a way, that the Depression, yes, had something to do with that. But people sometimes balk at the elderly and that they're going to be starring in this picture, because the poster art, it tried to obfuscate this, but it also came through. It's like, wait, who are these people at the top of this? And your friend comes back from the theater and they're saying it's like a heavy one, but I don't know. I think there's also comfort in experiencing something, even if it's pain, with someone else who has shared that pain. I think we need that. I think it's uplifting. It's just one of the most comforting feelings that we can have. I mean, I've gone through things in my life that no one else has had happened to them. And that has made it harder for me because I couldn't reach out for solidarity or know that someone else had come through that tunnel. It kind of was just me. And so this picture is a way of saying it's not just you. And take some inspiration from this couple at this heart of the movie.
Make Way for Tomorrow. It's not on any streaming services, but if you do get the Criterion Collection, you can find it there, and well worth your time and effort to search it down and watch this great Leo McCarey film.
Did you try okay.ru?
I did not. I did not, because I don't want the police coming for me.
Oh, have you heard bad things?
I'm not going on to the dark web. I'll pay the money. I don't want to be down there in the bowels of the interwebs. It scares me there, Colin.
Those of you out there less scared of Larry Law and Mr. Kimball, I am sure, I don't know this, but if you go on Google and type in Make Way for Tomorrow, space, OK.RU, hit return, I bet you're going to find plenty of options to see this for free, courtesy of the Russians. I mean, that's sort of the way to say it, right?
Yeah, all right.
Most things are on there, and you can even pick the edition you want, including, I'm sure, the Criterion one that is there. Oh, that would be funny. That would be surreal had you a knock. That's... That's some powerful paranoia you have there. Wow, I've never heard anything that before.
Russians, man, they're watching me already. Colin's upcoming book is called Watching Back, Writing on Movies That Light Us Up. Next week, we'll talk a little sports with Colin. Looking forward to this. Bruins, Celtics in the postseason. Oh, the Red Sox and their miseries and challenges. And we'll talk about Ken Dryden's The Game and much more next week. Thank you, Colin.
All right, sounds good.
We'll catch you then.